So, happy Halloween coming up. A variety of me. I'm secure in my gender identity, although I did get a little upset when the guy tried to look up my yellow skirt. That was irritating. Ode to Dexter, if you like Dexter. My daughter really liked Harry Potter, so I think I'm some wizard there. Anyhow, who's going to have a party over the weekend? Who's going downtown over the weekend? No. Has anybody heard we hold a party downtown, Kent? Has anybody heard of that over the holiday week? Never mind. All right, well, fine. It's Lecture 17. It's October 26th. Coming up is Halloween, but nobody cares. International marketing experience we talked about last time, so it's a reminder. This one's in Greece. Also, digital marketing should be an interesting course, especially because you can earn some industry certificates along the way, if that looks like it may be a part of your future. Mini test 7 closed on Saturday, and the average was 88. 93% of the students participated, and we know that 8 is up and running, closing on Saturday. Extra credit number 5, closing tonight. We skipped a week, and I may have misspoken about it, but it closes tonight. So if you want credit for that, be sure to do extra credit number 5 by tonight. So you guys have heard about this interesting position that Ye has chosen or not? Yeah, so Adidas ends relationship with Kanye West, now Ye, I think, over offensive behavior. Adidas is officially ending its relationship with Kanye West, now known as Ye, or Ye, following a weekend of intense pressure to drop the artist following a string of recent anti-Semitic remarks. So we like to talk, and I often talk about getting celebrities to represent your band and pairing up with the celebrities and how that brings positive attitudes, and then your celebrity goes and does something like this. So that's a danger of going with celebrities. Adidas does not tolerate anti-Semitism and any other sort of hate speech, said the ironically German, anti-Semitism, German, Holocaust, sportswear company in a press release on October 25th. Ye's recent comments and actions have been unacceptable, hateful, and dangerous, and they violate the company's values of diversity and inclusion, mutual respect, and fairness. After a thorough review, the company has taken the decision to terminate the partnership with Ye immediately, and production of Yeezy's branded products, and stop all payments to Ye, and his companies. So I'm going to argue for the sake of our class, corporate ethics. Then I'm going to make a snide remark on the side. The brand predicted the break with West would result in a short-term negative impact of up to $246 million, 250 pounds at the current exchange rate, on profits in the final quarter of 2022. Now, they did hang back for a bit before making this decision. And with that sort of impact, you can understand why they were hesitant to jump on the ethics bandwagon. But they were getting a lot of bad social media press, a lot of pushback, a lot of negative consumer comments for not disengaging from Ye. And so I say here the impact of public pressure on brands and maybe the decision of ethics over profits. But anyhow, the end result was this. Yeah? As green steel revs up to change the auto industry, are car makers ready for the race? So we're talking about new product developments. This is new product development in the B2B side of things, which eventually will become part of the B2C side of things, right? So in October, November unveiled the world's first vehicle made entirely of zero carbon steel, making steel in a traditional blast furnace that started in like 1879 and is still going today, produces a lot of pollution. Not so good. So their first vehicle in the upper right-hand side is the one that they showed. So this supports the UN sustainability goal, which we've talked about before and the college supports, to build, number 9, to build resilient infrastructure, promote inclusive and sustainable industrialization, and foster innovation. Our ambition is to have a fossil-free steel across all of our products, said a Volvo rep. Welcome to the next chapter in the greening of the motor vehicle business, the adoption of green steel, which refers to steel produced in furnaces that don't burn fossil fuels or emit carbon. So product innovation at that level, industry level, B2B, we'll see what happens on the B2C side. In February, for example, BMW pledged that green steel will make up 40% of steel used in its EU plants by 2030. In March, Volkswagen announced that it plans to begin using low-carbon steel in its Trinity One electric vehicles starting in 2026. I digress to ask, who knows the problem with believing what VW has to say in this matter, in these matters? Yeah, let me come up here a second, see if we are all on the same page about why, once you break corporate ethics, it's a little hard to go back to trusting you right away. Why am I being a little cynical about VW? So VW comes up with a really great no pollution, whatever it was, reduced pollution, producing car. And then the way it was getting no pollution was by cheating, software cheating, the emission standards. So you got to take a little cynical view of their new promise, but I'm going to go with the flow to be a nice guy. So Volkswagen announced it's going to do it too. Only a month later, Mercedes-Benz proclaimed it would introduce a green steel in several of its models as early as 2025. In the U.S., both Ford and GM have also made public commitments to incorporate no-carbon or low-carbon steels also. So here's the adoption of innovation globally in the B2B industry. Realistically, the road to adopting zero-carbon steel is going to be a long one. One benefit of talking about it now is the halo effect, a chance for automakers to look like responsible, even moral corporate citizens. So a bit about our brand sustainability image. Green steel itself may not get consumers excited, but as the latest addition to car companies' evolving commitment to reduce carbon emissions, it matters. That's the marketing win that automakers are going for, said a particular ad agent. Note that one piece is net, not that one piece is net zero. It isn't that only one piece is net zero. Rather, the whole vehicle is net zero, is what they're shooting for. But automakers are also worried, here we go, of promising too much, especially in view of the calamity that ensued in 2015. That's when Volkswagen's miraculous clean diesel engine turned out to be nothing more than a dirty old engine with cheat device implanted. If automakers don't make good on the pledges they're making about green steel, it could be a Volkswagen Dieselgate too. So only promise what you can deliver. Mercedes already has a contract in place with German firm Salzgitter to supply low-carbon steel. Together, we're setting the course to bring green steel into our series-produced vehicles as quickly as possible. The first prototype parts for body shells made of CO2-free steel from SAAB's plant are already being planned for next year. So here's the new product development process. You've got to ramp up factories to be zero emission. That can't be an easy thing to do overnight. So you've got to ramp that up. Ramp up the production, figure out how you're going to put it in cars, get it into cars. So it'll be impressive if they get some stuff going by next year, I think. Finally, we were talking about products. So there are big innovations like redoing the entire seal industry and how it impacts cars. And then there are little innovations like introducing a new color to the palette of M&M's candies, purple. Have you guys heard of Miss Purple? Purple? Okay, you've seen some of her. So new product development process, takes a while to get it done. Here it is. Purple was the first new color to join the lineup in more than a decade. Now M&M's and BBO, the ad agency, launched the character with a 15-second ad. So here we have a pretty low-risk, pretty continuous innovation. We talked about that kind of innovation last time from the consumer's viewpoint.
I'm a little unsure, I have to admit.
Just be yourself.
And you can do it!
That man in the plant seems to think I can. Thank you, Mr. Plant Man.
No problem,
girl. So there it is. That's part of a much too long video that introduces her as well. So in the ad, she's a little unsure. She meets a backstage man dressed like a plant who tells her, just to be yourself, you can do it. And he sings later in an operatic era song. Bored by the support, she moves on stage saying, thank you, Mr. Plant Man. Fans of Little Nas X, fans? Little, nah, am I saying that right? Little Nas, Little Nas. We'll love these new M&M candies. So here's a celebrity partnership. The M&M packs inspired by Little Nas come in pink, blue, and purple pastel colors with the face of the music megastar and cultural trailblazer on them, as well as hearts and butterflies. Not only is Lil Nas one of the most talented and influential musicians of our time, he's a catalyst for self-expression for his wide-reaching and massively diverse fan base. The M&M's brand knew he'd be the perfect collaborator to deliver on our purposes of creating a world where everyone feels they belong. We are thrilled to partner with Little Nas to support the power of the arts to create a positive societal impact on our society. So, celebrity partnership. For each purchase of the packs, M&M will donate $5 for a total of up to $100,000 to Sing for Hope. How can they donate $5 on a package of candy? Well, we're going to get to that in just a second. Sing for Hope, a nonprofit organization that uses the power of the arts to create a better world, so a bit of social responsibility. The partnership is part of the M&M Fund, a global initiative that provides resources, mentorships, opportunities, and financial support in the arts and entertainment space to help ensure people have access to experiences where everyone feels they belong. The limited edition M&M's pack, inspired by the Little Nas X, can be purchased for a mere $49.99. Well, you said you sort of liked them. At that website, a portion of the proceeds will benefit Sing for Hope. So here's an interesting price in the marketing mix for a, quote, new product. And how well that'll work, I don't know. All right, lecture notes, page 147, page 271 in the textbook, continuing our discussion of new products. And this ties into what we just talked about in our slides. So continuous innovations, like a new flavor M&M, dynamically continuous innovation. I'd have to think about that. A green car, all green steel, maybe dynamically continuous. Seems like we'd be on the borderline because it's not going to be hugely different. Shouldn't require much behavior changes. Probably on that borderline. And then discontinuous things entirely new to the world. All right, so as we think about what it takes to get one commercially successful new product, you've heard the expression, whether or not it's true, like 50% of the ideas out there fail in the first year. But where's it start? So this was a research study done a while ago with brainstorming. We're just going to think up ideas. No bad ideas here, right? So you start off with a bunch of people in a room. You generate some ideas. Maybe you come up with 58, 59, 60 new ideas. Some of them, of course, suck, but we don't say that right now. We get them up on the board. Now we begin to do a little analysis. We begin to screen them out. Are they practical, possible, fit with our mission? Stuff like that. So out of those 58, 59, 60 ideas you save, you getting through screening, you might have, you know, 13, 14 ideas that get through screening. Now, on those ideas, you can spend a little more time because, after all, every time you move down here, it's more time, it's more money, it's more, you know, cost to do. We're now going to get some analysts involved in running a business analysis. Does it seem like these things have enough market size? We could make a profit on them. Again, are they practical? So out of those 12, 13, 14 we had, now we're down to 6, 7, 8 ideas that we're now going to develop. We're now actually maybe going to set up, order the pieces and parts, get the components, get the steel, order, put together some examples. So we're going to develop those things. Takes a lot more time and a lot more money. Now, not all those things work out. So the supplier doesn't supply what we want. It doesn't work the way we thought it would. So out of those, whatever we had, 6, 7, 8, we got maybe, you know, 3 or 4. And now we're going to actually test these things, put them in a test market, have consumers come and play with it, have the people taste it. And out of those, you end up with like 2. And of the 2, you get 1 successful new product into the marketplace. And of course, that doesn't come cheap. Developing all that stuff over time, you better be making money back on the innovation that you put out there. So that's where we are. So what are some characteristics for a new product? Well, one is that the product offers up a relative advantage, that we have an enhanced bundle of benefits. I think last year, I don't remember if this is new this year, I looked up to see what are some new products out there that are exciting, that people like. How about the Ninja Food multi-cooker with tender crisp technology? Compared to your regular old cooking, if you're a cuisine fan, I presume that is an enhanced bundle of benefits for you. Compatibility. Products tend to be more successful when they're similar in the way you're used to consuming them, the patterns of behavior, the values that you have. Think about men's razors. 100 years ago, you had a single blade, you had to strop it, you had to trust you didn't cut your throat. Then they invented the safety razor. So you had a blade, blade with edge on each side. You shave for a while here till it got dull. Cut yourself. You shave the other way. Fine. Then they got to thinking, a lot of guys have beards. They got to shave down. They got to shave up. What if we find a way to improve on that razor idea? So they came up with an idea. How many people either do or know guys that do shave down and then come back against the grain to get a good, nice, close shave? Yeah. So you got a big beard. You go both ways. They came up with this great idea for their new product. It was going to be a razor with a blade here and a blade here, and you'd shave this way in a single go-through. So the blade would be here and here. Man, I can barely find my face in the mirror in the morning. You're not about to change the way that I shave my face. That idea went out, it was going to work. So they came up, of course, with originally the two blade on one side, right? Two blades. And then they had to explain to people how two blades were better than one. They had little cartoons that showed how the first razor cut. And before the beard jumped all the way up, the second would cut it as well. But it was compatible with the way we were used to shaving. Then, of course, it became three blades, four blades, five blades. I think that's where we stopped. So to be successful, it should be compatible with the way you're used to behaving. Here's a innovation that I found that year as a successful new product, the Ryan laptop bag. Functional laptop bags are rarely so stylish. It's about time a company has made an organized, fashionable laptop bag. Okay, it's fashionable and compatible with the way I'm used to doing things. Shouldn't be too difficult for me to understand as a new product. Trial ability. People don't like spending money on things that may not work. I don't know if you've ever done this, but I've been in the grocery store shelf. Maybe I'm looking for shampoo, and I see a new shampoo there. And the new shampoo is, I don't know what it costs, $9 for the bottle. I can afford $9, even though I'm a college professor. I can afford $9. But I look at it, I say, I'm going to buy that big bottle. It's $9. I'm going to take it home. I don't like it. What am I going to do? I'll just get my old one. I mean, a familiar sort of experience for anybody here? Yeah, occasionally. So I can't try it. Well, wait. What if they then produce on the little side? What if they produce a little bottle that I can buy for $1.50 or $2, the trial size? Now I might be able to try it. Not all products can be trialable, but that helps people to accept it. Get a free trial offer of Air Optiplex brand contact lenses when you sign up for iFile. Well, that might make me do it. I can try it. Interesting. Observability, you can see the newness in the thing. Here is a new bed frame. And yes, that does not look like my old bed frame. It does look new. So it might help me think about why I would consider such a new product. Simplicity, we say complexity is a disadvantage that slows diffusion. If it's complex to work with, that means I have to learn new behaviors, I have to learn new patterns, I have to learn new instructions. I don't want to do it. Sometimes I feel that way about new technology coming my way. Do I really want to relearn how to do whatever the thing is? Maybe not. So here's a pretty simple approach. Here's some new bespoke silverware, rainbow colors, but it's not too complex to understand. If it's in my interest set, I could probably do it. And then, of course, we would say, to be successful, you should have a good marketing mix that's well executed, emphasizing all of the appropriate elements of a new product. So we're now returning to the idea of developing a new product. So stage one is to think about the strategy that works for you, right? Where are we going to get that from? Well, what are strengths and weaknesses? We talked about that before. What are the opportunities and threats out there in the environment? Where can we match up those things to begin to suggest some areas for us? Plus, we have the entire set of crest factors. Competition, regulation, legal, and political factors, economic situation, changes in social trends, and technology. These things might begin to give us this idea of what sort of strategy we want to take to new product development. Then we're going to search for new product ideas. We just looked at coming up with 60 of them. So where do these come from? Well, they can come from salespeople, dealers, customers, engineers, R&D, all those cross-functional teams within your organization. Hopefully you have some nice software that helps you gather that stuff together. Then you can get it from places outside your organization, competitors, trade shows, ad agencies, market research. And then there are other places to deep dive into for new ideas. The Department of Commerce, the Patent Office, licenses, private labs, independent inventors, university labs. So here we're clustering up to that 60 new ideas. Whether or not they're all good yet, we don't know. But that's where they come from. So now we move to stage three of the process. Oh, here's Fred Hunt talking about a new product idea at Sherwin-Williams. How exciting is paint? Well, exciting. I mean, what's going to be new in paint that's going to be a new innovation? Fred helps us think about that with this.
Marketing is very much focused on the consumer, those who are actually the end user of the product. And at Sherwin-Williams, we're no different than most companies. As we're going through our course of business, we talk with our consumers all the time. And what I want to tell you is the story behind a successful product and how that conversation really helped to make it come to market. We know that when we talk about the do-it-yourself consumer, that person, that decision maker, is predominantly female. She really understands what she wants. She understands color. If she doesn't understand color, she finds out about it, and she makes that final decision. We also found that, in many cases, she was doing a lot of that in-home work and was actually enjoying it because she likes change every so often, and applying a coating of paint really helps make a change happen relatively quickly and relatively inexpensively. But she had a few things she was unhappy with. She didn't like some part of the process she didn't like, and we really did some great ethnographic look and deeply understood what she was doing when she got that product home. And what we discovered as we're watching her through that day, and it wasn't just one consumer, many, many consumers that we did this with, we found that one of the hardest parts of this job was, one, taking that can of paint from retail, the thin bale wire, and picking it up, and it was kind of heavy, and she wasn't that happy with that. And then once it was taken home, she had to open it with either a screwdriver or a tool that could be used to pop it open the can, and then it was still messy, you know, and it was not a whole lot of fun. She was doing it. It was traditional, but she didn't like it that much. So we started thinking around the innovative process of what if we could make it easier for her to, one, get the product at store, carry it, and then when she got it home, make it much easier to open, dispense, clean up, and keep. And from that came the idea of the twist and pour can, right? That twist and pour can is really a can that's got a plastic, it's plastic, it's got a handle on it, nice and thick, so she doesn't feel like she's hurting her ring or whatever else is there. It's really nice and thick and easy to handle. It, once opened, it's got a twist on it as opposed to popping it off with a screwdriver and then having to pound it back down with a mallet and it's spurting all over the place. You know, who knows what's going to happen there. We then had this can. She can now open it very easily, not that much tensile strength to get there, close it back up. When you open it, there's a spout. The spout pours it right into the wherever you want to use, whether that be a smaller bucket or whether the tray or something like that, and it captures all of the dripping piece, you know, of the paint back into and reclaims it back into the package, and virtually there's no mess there. Very easy to deal with, and you know that is a classic story of innovation. It's been very, very successful, but a classic story of the consumer saying, "I need this to be solved," the company finding a way to solve it, and then taking advantage of that and seeing more products sold.
So they do ethnographic research, which we've talked about. They follow a bunch of consumers around. They notice that when you pick that big bucket up at the store, it's got that little thin wire. It's cutting your finger. It's cutting your ring. It's bothering you there. How many of you guys have ever gone to close the can and have it splatter out around you? Yeah, I know how to do that stuff. I'm aware of it, and yet occasionally I will not pay attention. Pound it, splatter, not so good. And so they use this information to come up with an entirely new product, the plastic can. Nice wide handle, screw off lid, screw back on, pour it, reclaims stuff back into the can. Fantastic. New product innovation that worked well for them. It did not cannibalize all the other paint can sales. A lot of people just like the old traditional one, but some people like the new one as well.
Now there's a paint can that's as great as the paint that's in it. The original Twist and Pour paint container from Dutch Boy. Easy to hold, Easy to open. Easy to pour. For a neat way to paint. The original Twist and Pour paint container from Dutch Boy. Now available in quartz. For a retailer near you, visit DutchBoy.com.
Dutch Boy being a subdivision of Sherwin-Williams. So, all right, so we came up with this idea. So anyhow, we are now going to screen and evaluate all those ideas we came up with. So we're going to do an initial evaluation of market potential. Is the market large enough? Does it have demand? Does it solve a pain point? What's the competition look like? Does it fit in with the company mission and competencies? Can we do whatever this thing is? What effects would it have on the other products? Would this totally cannibalize our other paint can sales? Maybe it's not a great idea then. Raw materials, what kind of plastic do we need to do that? I don't know. Is there enough of it? Can it come? Is it recyclable? Patent position, can we patent this or can somebody steal it right away? Then we might do concept tests. We might ask people what they think about it before we put a bunch of money into it. So, do you paint at your home? Yes, I do. So you go to the store, you pick, can you tell us a little bit about that? Blah, 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 blah. Have you ever had this problem? It's, yes, I have. What would you think of this idea? Concept test. And we describe the idea. We see what they like, don't like. Does it seem plausible with them to go forth with this new product? Then we do business analysis. We check it against the customer needs. We establish that target market, checking on size, checking on profitability, check the competition, develop, remember STP, the target positioning, develop the initial product specs, do an economic analysis. As we go back and forth in the numbers and the analysis, we revise and refine as needed. On to stage five, we develop the thing. We check our supply chain processes, make sure it's all there, ready to go. We can get the pieces and parts. We check our manufacturing process, make sure they're up to speed on what the changes are. We make sure that our quality control system is ready. Our marketing programs are ready. As we go through all this over time, we're updating our costs, our financial plans, ensuring our target costs are going to be met. And imagine what that must be like now in the world that we're living in with inflation growing all over the place, supply chains being broken, being repaired. Must be rather tricky to do that sort of work, eh? On to stage five, development part two. So we create a prototype of the product. We lab test it. We have consumers try the thing, whatever it is, see how it works, see what the reaction is to our planned marketing mix. We get feedback and revision. We retest by consumers, go back and forth until we have something that we think is going to work.
What's really cool and interesting is in-home usage tests. We call it an iHut. So it's really powerful because instead of saying, like, let's imagine you're a yogurt company or maybe you're in the toothpaste industry, instead of saying, hey, we've got in a survey, we have a mint flavor, we have a cherry flavor, we have a strawberry flavor. What do you think sounds most appealing? Instead, these companies that we partner with are actually able to recruit their target demographic. So let's say they're looking for 30 to 54-year-olds for the toothpaste study. Once those people are screened and they qualify for that study, then we'll confirm their physical address, and actually the company will be able to send out those products. And so then, again, this kind of goes back to the power of us owning those member data sets, because they're then able to recontact them and follow up and say, okay, so you were testing that toothpaste for the last week. What did you like? What didn't you like? Did you like the flavors? Did you like, you know, how it foamed, et cetera, and actually get that real experience and feedback so that you can actually make those informed decisions. And that's been super powerful for our clients. Yeah, it's really cool, and so much to the point that I'm starting to ask, like, why don't we work with apparel companies? Like, why wouldn't an apparel company send out either images of threads or whatever, or, you know, particular pieces of clothes, because they can make more informed decisions instead of, like, hey, we didn't sell 1,000 shirts last year because nobody liked it.
So we see a company like Protégé, a market research firm, can help you move along in this development and see what is working, what isn't working, make revisions, retesting, etc. Then depending on your situation, your competitive situation, your market, you might be able to take this idea into test market, or if not, we could skip stage six and go to commercialization. But in test marketing, we are now going to run the real deal. We're going to develop one version with strawberry flavor and one version with cherry flavored, and we're going to put it all out with the product price place promotion in Rochester and product place promotion in Akron, and we're going to see the actual results, which one works better. All right? So we actually are able to see what's going on. Sometimes we have to use simulated test marketing. The product's too easy to copy. Competition will get in and screw with us with pricing or with their advertising. Sometimes it's not practical to get it into an actual test market. Then, if all goes well, we're into commercialization. We're going to launch the thing, ramp up our production, ramp up our purchasing of raw materials, activate our quality control stuff, train our sales force and our service personnel, have meetings with our dealers, run trade ads for our wholesalers and retailers and customer ads to get them to buy the product, hold a press conference. And finally, to stage 8, not mentioned in the book, evaluation of what happens. Seems like an important thing to do in management. So analyze the sales data, analyze the profits, see how your promotion worked, revise those things, adjust the product specs, reallocate your sales force, phase out weak items, and then over time, continuously improve the product depending on what goes on with the marketplace, technology, competition, social trends, etc. Yeah? So, it takes a lot of stuff to get those new products out there. So, we're working along our strategic marketing management framework. We're down here developing the marketing mix. We've been working on the product or the service that's coming out so far. And here's the idea of taking it all the way down to the market response and getting feedback from the whole process, which is what we're talking about. Evaluating what's going on, controlling what's going on, make changes as necessary. Let's turn the story around. We talked about why new products succeed. Let's think about why they fail. One reason they fail is you don't see any advantage in what the thing does, in what the thing is. Here is an idea for a new television.
At Sharp, our goal is to reproduce every color in the world on TV. Introducing Quatron QuadPixel technology. It adds a fourth color, yellow, to the standard RGB color system, creating a vast array of colors you can't see with your TV's three-color technology. But you can see this. Whoa! Oh, my.
Quatron from Sharp. You have to see it to see it.
And that is the problem. You have to see it to see it. Where typically would you see such an advertisement? Typically. On your TV. And what would you have seen? Just what we saw there. Did you see too little yellow on that screen? Have you ever sat in front of your TV screen and said, that doesn't have enough yellow? Where's the competitive advantage here with this idea? Hard to sell. Now, they aren't a dumb company. That didn't play out very well. They did modify things to focus on a different new element. Still a little tricky to see, but at least it's more
the future
pragmatic.
Of TV is here.
Sharp Aquos, world's first 8K resolution TV. There's nothing like it.
Now, I know I can't see it on my regular TV, but 8K, I got the concept. It's a lot sharper, whereas I've always seen yellow. I still seen yellow. What are you talking about? There's not enough yellow. It doesn't make sense. So, no competitive advantage being perceived by the consumer. Or the competition reacting in a way that messes with you. Initially, iPhone had a pretty good lock on the market for smartphones, needless to say, pretty quickly after they came up, others came into the marketplace. Badly positioned, so people can't quite figure out what the heck it is, what's the advantage, what's the benefit to what's going on. Lots of times, manufacturing is not being done right, and so we have a situation where we get poor quality. That's not going to cause a product to succeed. It doesn't do whatever you say it's going to do. Only promise what you can deliver. No benefits provided. Not enough marketing support. Low perceived value. I understand what you're saying it'll do, but it's not worth it to me to do that. No worth there. Bad estimates of market potential or other marketing research errors are going to cause products to fail. Forecasts are always dangerous, especially when they're about the future, so that can be a failure as well. Poor estimates of production and or marketing costs, more forecasting issues. Poor selection of marketing channels, it doesn't get out to your target market. You're doing everything great, and all of a sudden the environment changes, technology changes, a recession hits, supply chain issues come up. Products fail. So here's a little story on some of the greatest flops as of the time this little video came out. And that was a flop right there, wasn't it? Hello, you there? Wakey, wakey.
Hi, I'm Mimi Chahaman for 24/7 Wall Street, and today we're taking a look at some of the worst product flops of all time. Big companies sometimes have to take big risks and spend big bucks to find the next it product. But those attempts aren't always successful. In fact, they can sometimes be downright epic failures. To identify some of the worst product flops of all time, 24/7 Wall Street reviewed products introduced by America's largest companies from 1950 onwards. Here's a look at the worst five. At number five, it's Wow Chips. Made with the fat substitute Olestra, Wow Chips were marketed as a healthier snacking option, and public perception followed until Olestra turned out not to be the miracle ingredient consumers initially believed it to be.
Most people weren't hoping for cramps and diarrhea as a result of one of the benefits of using this new product. That's what they got.
At number four, it's Hot Wheels and Barbie computers. As part of an attempt to reconcile the declining sales of Barbie dolls and growing sales of software and CD-ROMs, Mattel joined forces with Patriot Computers, but manufacturing flaws were ultimately their undoing.
Just what we said in the examples, you would think that the Barbie is a big company. They know what they're doing. They didn't have a good handle on their manufacturing. Kids don't want products that don't work. It was a failure in the manufacturing side.
At number three, it's Easy Squirt Ketchup. Heinz added a little color to its game with this range of differently colored ketchup and matching squeeze bottles aimed at youngsters, who ate it up, but for less than 6 years.
So it was a different colored ketchup, not just red. It tasted the same. It was fun for a while, but the social norms, right, moved on. The value moved away. Product went away.
At number two, it's the touchpad. Hewlett-Packard's answer to Apple's iPad was unveiled with an extremely costly, celebrity-filled advertising campaign. Sales, however, didn't come close to matching the roughly...
So you're doing that forecast? How much revenue are we going to get in? It's going to cover our costs. We're going to be fine. We'll pay for all those... Oops. Didn't work.
$15 billion marketing budget. And at number one, it's Google Glass.
Google Glass
was introduced on the principle that technology should be there when you need it and get out of your way when you don't. After 2 years of disappointing sales, it was clear that consumers did not need Google Glass. And there you have it, the five worst product flops of all time.
Big investment, big research, big cost, big production, big marketing, big failures. And so people didn't value what Google Glass was bringing to the table. Maybe sometime in the future we'll see something different. So, research, research, research. Hope it all goes well for you. All right, so this is the development of new products. We're now going to think about, we're going to wonder where we put our slideshow. We're going to think about how we're going to manage these new products that we put out. And I would have thought I had it there, but maybe I didn't. See, you're there somewhere. Do we see managing chapter 10? Apparently it's out there somewhere. I'm just not seeing it. Down to the right? Oh, it's hidden in the window. Thank you. That's the new round classroom in the new building. I don't know how the heck that's going to work. How are you going to teach 360 degrees? Seems silly. I'm sorry, Dean. This seems like a great idea. All right, so chapter 11, I like to keep my job. Chapter 11, lecture notes, page 158, managing the products and brands that you've created that are out there. I know, and I apologize in advance, sometimes I do just get overwrought with my examples, and Starbucks for me was a really great example. There is a little too much information here about how they manage the brand over time and how they manage against competition, how they roll out. So just bear with me. I know it's a little much, but how many people like Starbucks? All right, so little story of Starbucks here. So the early years. The first Starbucks was opened in Seattle, Washington, on March 30th, 1971. Their goal was to sell high-quality coffee beans for people to use in making coffee at home. That was their goal, not to make in-home, in-store drinks. In 1982, they've been out there for a while, Howard Schultz, the new director of retail operations and marketing, took a trip to Milan, Italy. On his return, he advised that the company should think about selling coffee and espresso to drink in the shop, as you often see in these little Italian coffee places, people sitting and drinking. In addition to the whole bean coffee, leaf teas and spices that they've been offering. What do you suppose management says? What do you think they might say? Just play with me here. Just entertain me. What might they say? They might say what?
Sure.
They might say sure, but no, that wasn't their mission. They said no. They rejected this stupid idea of having people come to your coffee shop and drink coffee. So they felt that getting in the beverage business would distract them from its primary focus of creating, selling beans. To them, coffee was something we prepared in the home. They did give away free samples of pre-made drinks so people would know what it tasted like, but they were selling beans. So Schultz was sure there was a market for pre-made drinks, so he started a competitive cafe, I guess, Il Giornale. I think that's how you say Il Giornale. Anyhow, a coffee bar chain in April of 1986. So he went that route. In 1987, the original Starbucks management decided to focus on Pete's Coffee and Tea, so they sold the Starbucks retail unit that they had to Schultz for $3.8 million. Pretty good buy. When I put this together, that was worth the franchise is worth $26 billion. Okay. Schultz rebranded the Il Giorno with the Starbucks name, and he aggressively expanded Starbucks' reach across the United States. So he's growing. Starting from 17 Seattle-based stores in 1987, Schultz expanded rapidly to other cities, Vancouver, Portland, and Chicago. By 91, Starbucks had also expanded into the mail-order catalog business and licensed airport stores, and further expanded into the state of California. By 92, Starbucks had grown to 165 outlets, and the first international location for a Starbucks was in Tokyo in 1996. Currently, Starbucks is present in more than 59 countries, with more than 24,000 worldwide stores, including more than 13,000 in the U.S. Now, it's my understanding, talk about cultural differences, global differences. Well, I back up a little bit and say how silly it is, how hard it is to forecast how things will go. So, as I said before, I used to take students to Paris all the time on part of my trips. I'm looking around Paris, and the French obviously like their coffee shops. They like sitting in the little tables, drinking really bad coffee, watching the world go by. I said to myself, no way is Starbucks going to expand into France, into Paris. It's not going to work. The next time I went back, Starbucks was the coffee shop in the restaurant area of the Louvre. Oops. They accepted the coffee. I was wrong. But as I understand it today, there are still no Starbucks successful stores in Italy. They haven't accepted it. They like drinking their bad coffee the way it is. Cultural differences in terms of how products will succeed. So it's my understanding that they have not yet made inroads, successful inroads into Italy. So they managed the product and brand extensions. In the early 90s, they used the internet to offer people the option to purchase Starbucks coffee online. And then in 2009, they offered it for their instant coffee via. 95, they offered Starbucks coffees on United Airlines flights. They also, in that year, produced premium coffee ice cream with Dreyer's, so a brand partnership. Dreyer's is good ice cream. Starbucks is good coffee. How about combining the two for a partnership? In 97, they introduced Starbucks Barista Home Espresso machines, featuring a new Porta filler system that accommodated both ground coffee and Starbucks' new ready-to-use espresso pods. 98, they offered chai tea latte. Anybody ever have a chai tea latte? Pretty good, yeah. At Starbucks, a combination of black tea, exotic spices, honey, and milk. 98, they distributed whole bean and ground coffee out to supermarkets. 99, they sold premium teas through Starbucks' own Tazo Tea Company stores. 2005, they started selling CDs in their retail stores because in 99, they had purchased Hear Music as a record label and music marketer. 2008, they started a community website, My Starbucks Idea, to collect suggestions and feedback from customers, engaging the customers, building relationships with them. 2008, they also introduced a loyalty program. 2009, they introduced a new line of instant coffee packets called Via Ready Brew. And talking about this new, has anybody ever tasted Via? Have you seen the Via instant coffee at all? So in talking about it, Schultz said, instant coffee won't tarnish Starbucks' premium image. For less than a dollar a cup, people can have a cup of coffee that's the mirror image of what they get at Starbucks. I tried it. I don't know. I'd say it's a mirror image, but okay, that's what they said. So in 2010, they diversified into Seattle's Best. How are we going to sell coffee that doesn't tarnish our image? Starbucks, the premium coffee chain, expanding further into mass market, lower-priced coffee brands that will help it compete with the alternatives offered by players like McDonald's. We'll get to McDonald's as competition in a few minutes. Buoyed by the success of the instant coffee Via, Starbucks is making its second strategic move into mass market coffees by revamping the Seattle's Best coffee brand to compete against McDonald's. McDonald's came into direct competition with Starbucks when it upgraded its coffee in 2006. The lower priced option for McDonald's became popular among price sensitive customers and created new competition for Starbucks. As a result, the average number of customers visiting a Starbucks store declined from an estimated 460 in 2005 to just above 400 in 2007. Anytime you're doing something, making money and being successful, somebody's going to rear their ugly head and say, I'd like a piece of that action. I wonder if I can satisfy those consumers better than you are, in this case at a cheaper price point. Starbucks did a strong launch of its Seattle's Best brand coffee at more than 30,000 fast food outlets, supermarkets, and coffee houses. The company's expansion plans includes featuring Seattle's Best at convenience stores, drive-through kiosks, and vending machines. Through Seattle's Best, Starbucks can sell cheaper coffee without cheapening the Starbucks name. So they didn't call it Starbucks Light. They didn't call it Starbucks Special. They changed the brand name. That's part of their branding strategy, which we'll talk about, to be something different, Seattle's Best. The ball is now in McDonald's court as the chain remodels and upgrades the interiors of hundreds of restaurants. The next move, bringing Wi-Fi, which has obviously been accomplished by now, into the shops is progressing. And at year's end, over one-third of the shops worldwide were online. This is possibly the best news for customers, as they now in many areas can have a burger and fries with their special coffee as they surf the internet. Now, not all brand ideas work out as you try to expand and grow. In 2012, Starbucks paid about $620 million for Teavana, hoping to jumpstart the next wave of growth in this dynamic category. They bought the Teavana brand into Starbucks locations. They held on to Teavana's own retail stores and even opened a few new high-end Teavana fine teas, tea bars. Anybody see the Teavana up at Beachwood Mall by any chance? Teavana was there for a while. Yeah, well, you have to trust me. It was up at Beachwood for a while. But in July 2017, Starbucks announced its plan to shut all 379 Teavana stores over the coming year, with the majority of Teavana-only stores set to close by the spring of 2018. So you're trying to grow. You're watching the markets. You're watching consumers. You're watching trends. You sink a lot of money in a new idea. Even Schultz doesn't always win. 2016 fall, growing single-serving pods. In addition to inking new agreements with Keurig Green Mountain Inc. to sell K-Cups in more channels in North America, in 2012 they began at Walmart stores, Starbucks plans to launch branded pods for the Nestle's Nespresso machines in international markets later in 2106. That's a little planning. Later in, pretty sure that had to be 2016. So let's think about how they manage their brand image, starting with their brand logo, which has obviously over time achieved very broad visual recognition. But there's the original logo when he takes it over. The original logo, created in 1971, was fashioned after a 15th century Norse woodcut, the image of a mythical two-tailed mermaid siren. was on it. With a coffee brown color scheme, the circular ring surrounded the mythological mermaid figure contained the text, Starbucks, coffee, tea, spices. And the overall image was designed to resemble a cigar band label. The symbolism of the mermaid siren was intended to suggest the irresistible and seductive quality of coffee itself. Who knows enough about mythology to know the little thing that they aren't talking about mermaids and sirens? Jason and the Argonauts and all that. Yeah, and? Yes, and? Nobody knows classic mythology at all? Webbies, do you know classic mythology? One person? So sirens and the Argonauts, but else, would pull the sailors into their island, wrecking them on the rocks, and I think eating them, or putting them into slavery, or killing them. They missed that part of the mythology. All right, so when Howard Schultz purchased Starbucks in 1987, the Starbucks logo was cleaned up a little bit, a little more befitting a new corporate image. The bare breasts of the original mermaid were covered up by the mermaid's flowing hair, although her belly button was still visible. Maybe that was a big deal in 1987. The color scheme was changed from a brown in the original logo to the familiar green that he had established by his Il Giornale logo. The text surrounding the circular band was changed to just Starbucks coffee. So a little change there in terms of image. In 1992, the third image crops the image of the mermaid with a close-up view. Her navel is no longer visible. The mermaid's tail on either side are mostly obscured, which creates some mystery if you didn't follow the changing logo. And question for those that aren't familiar with the logo, what is that stuff on the side? 2011, for its 40th anniversary, Starbucks debuted the most recent logo, which brings the iconic mermaid out of the circle and drops the word Starbucks coffee. Why would you want to drop your brand name from your logo? Yeah. They already know your brand, but I think Ford still says Ford. Actually, the answer is going to hear it on the screen. It's coming up. CEO Howard Schultz said it embraces, respects our heritage, yes. At the same time, it evolves us to a point we feel is more suitable for the future. The fact that it's no longer tied to the English language makes it more marketable on the international level. Indeed, we know what it is. We recognize it, and we don't have to worry about, do people understand the language? Do we have to put it, you know, left to right, right to left, use different vocabulary? Now competition begins to rear its ugly head. We already touched on that a little bit. 2007, customer traffic declined for the first time since the company went public, sending the stock tumbling. 2008, the Great Recession. Starbucks found itself in an economic climate that had most people reassessing their daily spending habits on luxury items. Sound familiar? The company's revenues and profit tumbled as a result. Starbucks was hurt by rising costs, cannibalizing effects of years of overexpansion, stiff competition in the espresso drinks from McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts. By the end of fiscal 2008, Starbucks stock, once seemingly invincible, had declined, ouch, by over 50%. In January 2008, Starbucks ousted its chief executive, James L. Donald, and brought back Schultz to try to invigorate the company. Schultz laid off 1,000 employees, closed 600 underperforming locations in the U.S. I don't know if we used the phrase here previously, but economically, a rising tide raises all ships, if I used that expression before. So even marginal stores, when the economy is growing, they're doing okay, right, overall, because it's growing. When that recession begins to hit, that overexpansion, have you been to New York City and seen a Starbucks on this corner, and down the block there? Too many stores. And so as that economy begins to shrink, things begin to get tough. You got to start laying off people and closing stores, which he did do. At the same time, Starbucks moved aggressively to open stores overseas where business remained robust. It also introduced new discount program like the $25 gold card, 10% off on all items. The strategy sparked a comeback. Schultz is pretty good at that. For the coffee powerhouse in 2010, Starbucks' profit was $948.3 million. 2011, it was up over 14% to $1.7 billion. So let's back up to the competition talking about McDonald's. January 7th, 2008, they announced they're going to take on Starbucks, installing coffee bars complete with baristas in its 14,000 U.S. locations. Obviously, they've done a good job with McCafe. Who's ever had a McCafe coffee? Have you ever seen a barista in a McDonald's? I don't think that idea caught on. Apparently that was their goal, that we'd have baristas like they do at Starbucks. I don't think that caught on. But McCafe did. McDonald's and Starbucks had two diverse customer bases until McCafe was born of McDonald's and specialty coffee married fast food. While for the most part, customer bases are still far apart, it's the middle ground where customers could go either way. That's the war's focus. It's been easier for McCafe to hone in on specialty coffee than for Starbucks to compete in the fast food arena. Most Starbucks outlets don't have kitchens, so the food is of the wrapped sandwich variety and pastry type. Slowly, the company is implementing ovens, so at least some food items can be warmed up to be served hot. I think most of them now have those big, bulky ovens they put things into, and they can warm stuff up. It's still not a McDonald's, but they've changed the way that they run their retail stores to compete. Meanwhile, 2011, America runs on Dunkin', the tagline for the ever-popular Canton, that's not Canton, Ohio, that's like Canton, New England, based donut coffee chain can soon be interpreted more literally, as this morning's IPO of Dunkin' brand looks to raise over $400 million. The money will be spent in part to build out the brand beyond its northeastern stronghold, where they would look to compete with the likes of McDonald's and Starbucks Corporation. The recession was considered a hamburger and beer consumption period. The proof may be the success of McDonald's sales. 2007, 2008, 2009, McDonald's did well both in the U.S. and overseas, and analysts attribute that to their decision to keep prices low and the addition of a new line of coffee and drinks to compete with Starbucks. McDonald's was clever enough to price its coffee products below those that Starbucks customers had to pay. So we saw some hands. How many people go either or? So sometimes you do McDonald's and sometimes you do Starbucks, either or. Who when they drink coffee does McDonald's but wouldn't do Starbucks? Anybody do Starbucks but won't do McDonald's? You're allowed to raise your hand. So yeah. All right. So you're a Starbucks fanatic. Forget that. Forget that cheap McDonald's coffee. The McDonald's plan, which was copied by Dunkin' Donuts, was credited with taking market share from Starbucks. The twin problems of the recession and McDonald's success caused Starbucks to fire 12,000 people and close hundreds of stores. Guys, remember Mrs. Fields? Do you know Mrs. Fields' cookies? No. Mrs. Fields was massively popular earlier. For the generation that came of age in the 80s, no trip to the mall seemed complete without a visit to Mrs. Fields' cookies, or at least a pause in front of the store to savor the wafting scent of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. A lot has happened since then, including the chain's bankruptcy and comeback, the rise and fall of Krispy Kreme, Starbucks domination, lattes at McDonald's, and dozens of other food and beverages. Mrs. Fields, though, as of 2011, I haven't checked recently, has 208 stores in the U.S. competing on that front as well. Then McDonald's decided in 2012 that people were probably getting tired of paying for Starbucks lattes, and so they would be willing to slum it on something just as frothy but for a lot less money. Fast food chain has started to shift its focus from food to pricey beverages because the beverages are driving revenue more than ever. In fact, it's gotten to the point where Starbucks had better start viewing the fast food chain as serious rival. Yeah, they did. They were losing market share. For summer 2012, McDonald's introduced the McCafe Cherry Berry Chiller, $2.89 for a 6-ounce cup, 16-ounce cup. McCafe Frappe Chocolate Chip, $3.99 for a 16-ounce cup. Starbucks Frappuccino is more expensive, $5.45 for a 16-ounce cup than McDonald's version, but some say these ice-blended drinks are still a lot for a fast food restaurant. Anybody ever have a McCafe Cherry Berry Chiller, McCafe Frappe Chocolate Chip, or something like that at McDonald's? Is that something we've had? Perhaps it came and went. So the point of this longish babble is changing consumer tastes and competition require us, marketers, businesses, to actively and successfully manage their products and their brands. Schultz is pretty good at it. Other people running Starbucks have not been very good at managing the product and the brand. Over time, all products go through what's called the product life cycle. They have to be developed. They don't come from nowhere. And we've already talked about the idea of developing a new product and how long it takes and what you have to stage you have to go through, how expensive it can be. And in that early stage, how much money are you making from the product while it's being developed? Zero. You're losing money. You're spending money. Maybe fistfuls of money. You're losing money. Yeah, I'll get to that. So you're losing money. Now you begin to introduce the product into the marketplace. Do you make money right away? Probably not. It takes a while to ramp up inventory, wrap up advertising, get your product into stores, get the stores selling it, get consumers buying it. So it takes a while, even after you've developed it and get into market introduction. I just don't want to interrupt. Into market introduction for you to start making money. So now you begin to grow. What's going to happen as soon as you start being successful and growing? What have I been saying is going to happen? Nobody has it. Yeah. Competitors going to come in the marketplace. I can't believe he's making money on that. Look at how good he's doing. I need some of that action. So just as you're getting money and being successful, competition comes in and starts eating your lunch. So now you got to react to that. Then you move into the maturity stage. Profits have peaked and beginning to decline. And eventually, all products over time are going to go into the decline stage. You have to decide what to do. Now, this diagram shows the aggregate demand over an extended period of time for all brands in a product category. Your particular company could fail a lot quicker than that. You may not last the entire thing, but this is the overall industry. So the product life cycle and the profit curves vary from product category to product category. This is the basic shape that we often see when we look at this sort of issue. So negative profits in the early stages. You've been spending money on development. You've been spending money on building up inventory, getting stuff out. So you got to get some sales sometime to offset the product development costs. You should be so lucky that you succeed. Then you're successful, competition is coming in, so what starts eating into your profits? Well, the need to fight off competition by increasing advertising, increasing sales efforts, cutting prices, developing new versions perhaps of the product to fight off competition. And do you want to be the innovator or do you want to be the follower? So deciding when to enter a market can impact your profitability. Let's take a look at digital cameras. So digital cameras first came out in October 1981. Okay? So Sony launched the Mavica still camera with magnetic recording in 1981, in anticipation of the arrival of the magnetic recording still camera, Canon formed a task force to develop a magnetic recording color still camera in October 1981. Time moves on, and in 1986, the first commercially marketed still video digital camera came out. $2,458 for that digital camera in 1986. Things progress. The Apple QuickTake 100, launched in 1994, was actually manufactured by Kodak, who obviously lost this race overall, and was the first color digital camera for under $1,000. It packed a whopping 640 by 480 pixel CCD and could stash up to eight pictures in its internal memory. Wow. All that for under $1,000. The Casio QV10, new in 1995, was the first with an LCD screen on the back. Other now familiar features included macro positioning, automatic exposure, auto playback of images, and it cost $1,000. Smart media card and compact flash cards arrived in 96. The first camera to use the compact flash was Kodak. Look at that, $499, fighting the competition. Canon PowerShot G1, released in 2000, listed at Best Buy for $800. And what was that? So that was 2000. Things have moved on over the years. So digital camera sales have dropped 84% since 2010. Why? Well, obviously the big deal is your smartphones. Any of your parents have a digital camera, not a smartphone, at home? Digital camera. They use it? You have one, so you must be into photography. And you feel it takes better pictures than you can get on your smartphone. All right? Everybody else thinks different. So smartphones beat the heck out of that market, and you can see that things dropped out. So here's smartphones, what smartphones have done to the camera industry. Worldwide shipments of photo cameras since 1951. Anyhow, you can see that by 2010, we've got smart cameras coming out, smartphones coming out, and people are not buying cameras anymore. So the product life cycle at work. This is just the growth of digital voice assistants over time, so it's still on a growth curve. So let's go over these stages of the product life cycle and think a little bit about what it means for us in marketing. So we're in the introduction stage of the product life cycle. Who is going to pay, what was that first number for the camera? I forget what it was. $2,500 for a new camera, digital camera. Innovators, I want the latest, the newest, the best. I want to be the first kid on the block to own whatever the thing is. And I know it's going to drop over time. I know it's going to be less expensive over time. That's not my motivating factor. I want the newest, I want the best, whatever it is. Anybody an innovator in some field here, whether it's technology, clothing, cars, something, a little bit, what area? Shoes, all right. I'm willing to pay more money. I know I can get it cheaper at designer, wear it, whatever it is, but I want the latest stuff there. Competition, because it's new, there's not a lot of it yet, okay? Sales are low. It's introduction stage of the product life cycle, but it's going to grow. And profits, for reasons we talked about right now, still getting back on those development costs, probably none. So what do we have to do? Well, for truly new products, we've got to convince people what the thing is. We have to develop the market for the thing. Cost per unit are high. Longer production runs drive down unit costs, but right now we're early in that thing. We don't have the benefit of lots of products being produced. Product strategy is undifferentiated because we're the only one out there. It's brand new. Pricing strategy is probably most likely high. You want to try to recoup those development costs before competition comes in, and there are a bunch of innovators out there willing to spend a bunch of bucks on it. Distribution is going to be scattered because retailers, wholesalers don't know what it is yet. Retailers don't know what it is yet, so you got to work on that. And the promotional strategy for a truly new product is getting people aware of what the thing is, what the category is. We all know 3D printers, right? We all know the concept. How many of you guys have one at home? One person. What do you make with it?
Phone cases.
Seems like a great idea. I could make a phone case. How come we don't all have it? Well, we're not that innovative yet. Do you recall what yours cost?
Like
200 bucks. Well, obviously the price curve has dropped down a little bit since I put this together. So here we have the Form Labs Form 2 for $3,500, the Lutzbox Mini 3D for $1,250, the MakerBot Replicator for $2,900, and the UltraMaker 2 for $2,800. Notice all these end in, almost all these end in odd numbers, lower than the next dollar up. I was shorthanding it here, and we'll talk about it when we talk about pricing. But pretty expensive right now. At $200, maybe I'd try it, although I have to learn the new technology. So we're trying to stimulate demand for the entire product category rather than single brand to let people know what this thing is. It's something you might want at home. Growth stage. Yay. We moved along. It's successful. It's out there. Who are our customers now? The innovators are done with you. They're on to something else. Now we're into the mass market. Competition is beginning to take notice of how successful you are. You're making money. So they're beginning to pay attention. Their competition is increasing. Sales, well, it is the growth stage of the product life cycle, so they're rapidly increasing. And profits are strong, and then they're going to peak as you have to start fighting off competition. We were just successful. Now we've got to, all right. So we're now doing penetration marketing, trying to get deeper into that market that we've created. Our unit costs, because now we have long production runs, are declining. Product strategy, again, to fight off competition, we want to improve product features, come out with, you know, a little tastier version. Pricing strategy is going to go lower over time as competition forces you down. The distribution strategy, well, you're probably in this growth phase. People really want you. It's probably as intensive as you're going to be. And your promotion strategy now is to build brand preference. Everybody knows what it is. They want it. You have to make sure they're buying yours instead of the competition. As profits fall, you need more resources to attract customers away from the other offerings, and that's going to cut into your profits more. So it's an interesting time to stay active in the marketplace. Maturity. You've been out there. Everyone knows what this thing is. They've been using you for a while. So it's, again, the mass market, but competition is really intense. Probably everybody who's coming in has come in. Sales, well, it's probably not growing much and maybe even beginning to slow down to decline. Profits declining annually, you're fighting off competition. So you're going to have a defensive position. Hey, you want us, we're good against all that competition. Costs are stable or maybe even increasing. Product strategy differentiated from the competition. Pricing strategy is probably going to reach the lowest price point that you have in the maturity stage. Distribution, again, stays intensive. And why do people buy from you? You've been there forever. They know you. They like you. They're going to buy based on brand loyalty. So we are going to continue to try to differentiate ourselves from this intense competition. The decline stage. Why do brands decline? Well, because better or less expensive products come out that meet the same need, or the need for the product disappears entirely due to product development. Used to be, in the old days, kids sat on the front porch and played board games. I don't know if you guys did that while growing up, but a lot of board games have been replaced by kids sitting in the basement playing on their computer with video games, right? So the whole landscape has shifted, and board games are pretty far into the maturity, in many cases into the decline stage. How many guys recognize that thing on the left? Okay, do you have one at home? Used to be, that was the thing. What is it, in case you don't know? It's a juicer. It's how you got fresh juice in the old days. You squeezed it out. Then they improved it. If you still wanted one today, they got the fancy one, right? But, of course, they're made unimportant by things like what? Frozen. You guys still remember frozen orange juice? You take it out, it would come out of the freezer. Would make that sound, you stir it up. That went away, too, once they figured out a way to put it all in a, store it in a container like that. So we can see how this would impact the sales of the product. So I got one more minute on my clock. Let me just wrap this up. Customers, the only ones left in the decline stage are those that are truly loyal to you. Competition is giving up. They're decreasing. Sales are declining. You're in the decline stage. Profits are really low. So your strategy, either be efficient or exit, prune your line. You might even be able to increase pricing for those few remaining people. Distribution is selective, and your promotional strategy is reinforcement. Obviously, people are getting walking up because it's 4:59. I will let you go and continue this next time. Have a safe holiday weekend.